This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there, this is Kevin Lindsay, co-host of the Systems and Cybernetics podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, it's my pleasure to be in conversation with Dr. Martin Reynolds, who is co-editor, along with Sue Holwell, of Systems Approaches to Making Change, a Practical Guide, second edition published in 2020 by Springer. Martin Reynolds is a co-founding member of and lead academic liaison for the Applied Systems Thinking in Practice, or ASTIP, at the Open University in the UK. Martin received his degree in liberal studies in science at the University of Manchester in 1978 and gained his PhD in international development at the Institute for International Development Policy and Management at the University of Manchester in 1998. In the interim, he taught science at senior secondary schools in London and in Botswana. Martin has been actively involved with UN initiatives in developing systems for supporting the implementation of sustainable development goals, and collaborated with colleagues from social enterprise impact hubs in developing learning systems for effective monitoring and evaluation. Good day, Martin, and thanks very much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this. Thanks.
Well, yeah, pleasure is all mine. So I'd like to start the conversation by hearing a bit more about you. I'd love you to talk about how you developed an interest in systems thinking, what drew you to it, and talk a little bit about your particular areas of interest, maybe where you've seen the most potential for and impact from systems thinking.
Yeah, sure. My interest in systems thinking actually came from my PhD, my doctorate studies at the Institute for Development Policy and Management. And there I was studying the implementation of participatory rural appraisal in Botswana, a country that I knew very well. And it was at a time in the 1990s when they were exploring quite voraciously the ideas of participatory development. And there was a particular appraisal technique called participatory rural appraisal, Robert Chambers' work, which was being implemented, and it had a lot of political connotations to it, which in the development field at that particular time, in the early 1990s, didn't really have a critical aspect to it. Now, I became aware during my studies for the Masters of at the Institute for Development Policy and Management of a small systems course on soft systems methodology. actually presented by a colleague of mine from the Open University, a very close colleague of mine, Simon Bell, who, as it turned out, in later years. And so I saw some sort of synchrony between the participatory rural appraisal and the soft systems methodology. And then within this, when I started looking at the systems approaches, I saw that there was some very interesting stuff on critical systems thinking, which was giving a more political, ethical angle on soft systems thinking, which provided the tools for me to then provide a critique of participatory rural appraisal.
Got it. I think the journey, whenever I talk to folks like you who have had such a long journey in systems thinking, it seems to me that there was a lot of experiences that really kind of shape and inform, you know, your use of the theory, your use of the models when you're kind of out there in the field. So I'd love to hear about, you know, you talk about the intervening years, you were teaching in Botswana. Obviously, you would have been teaching within a very different system than that which you had experienced in the UK. What are some of the things that maybe informed you from the outside, if you will?
Yeah, it was mostly, actually, it's not so much in the teaching experience of Botswana, but it was observing what was going on around me. I spent 10 years teaching at a secondary school, teaching science in Botswana. But it came to my notice that there were a lot of development agencies working in Botswana under the sort of main rubric, if you like, of alleviating poverty. There's a lot of money and human resources going into Botswana, which at the time, and still is actually, a very low populated country, but having quite high levels of particularly rural poverty. And it struck me that there was a lot of investment into rural poverty by international aid agencies, a lot of goodwill going on, but with very little actual effect. So clearly there was something going wrong with the system. And I think it was that kind of sort of seeded something in my mind about, well, how is it that you can try and get over this eternal problem of matching the very goodwill for development policies in general with more positive outcomes? So it spoke to the sort of notions of systemic failure, as we would sort of understand it now, and what is it that causes that recurring sort of cycle of events, cycle of activities that actually don't alleviate poverty, don't address the initial aim or the wider aim of the system, but in fact just perpetuates it. And so I was interested in looking at that, you know, as a kind of a system, I guess.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. So when we were setting up this conversation, you mentioned to me that Open University was recognizing, celebrating, I think, is it 50 years of systems thinking?
50 years, yeah.
And I appreciate the invitation. Unfortunately, that was, I think, 4 o'clock in the morning for me here in California. I had great aspirations for setting my clock and getting up and joining you, but alas, I did not. So I was just wondering if you could, share some highlights from that. Like have you come to after 50 years? Were there any interesting revelations or highlights from the event you'd want to share?
I certainly should say that I haven't been there for 50 years, but it's 50 years of the starting of a systems group of practitioners. So the Open University is a distance learning university. It's the first distance learning university, I think, in the world of open supported distance learning. That started in 1969. And then in 1971, there was fairly shortly after the start of the OU, there was a group of practitioners coming together and were interested in using systems thinking ideas and developing courses around that. So it became that there was a systems group, and that group now it has its current incarnation, and as you mentioned in the introduction, of the Applied Systems Thinking in Practice group, the ASTIP group, which I'm one of the academics representing that group. So in the course of those 50 years, the OU produced a series of undergraduate courses to start with, initially, and around systems thinking, and very explicit just on systems thinking. And so it provided mature age undergraduates or scholars, if you like, to use systems thinking ideas for their practice. Now, I joined in 2001, around about then, and there was still just the undergraduate program. So after I started there, or shortly after I started at the Open University, I worked with colleagues, including Ray Eisen and Magnus Ramage and Sue Holwell, amongst others, Chris Blackmore. We started working on a postgraduate program of systems thinking in practice, and that sort of kicked off in 2009. In fact, we started the preparation for that around about 2006, 2007. For Open University courses, there's quite a long lead-in time for the development phase. And so when we started thinking about the postgraduate work, we saw that there was a gap in the market, if you like, in the offerings, around a concise sort of publication on some key systems approaches. And so that it's through the development of that course in systems thinking in practice, one of the core modules there, one of the two core modules, was associated with strategic thinking, and the first edition of Systems Approaches was the main core reader for that. Another colleague of mine, Magnus Ramage, co-edited or co-authored a book on systems thinkers as well, which coupled systems approaches quite nicely, gave a nice complement to it. Yeah,
got it. So let's get down to talking about the book, you include the preface to the first edition, which, as you said or indicated, you know, it's about 10 years since that one came out, since the first edition came out. But you say this book is about intervention, or more precisely, how to improve human intervention to help change situations for the better, to navigate the interrelated dimensions of making more effective strategic decisions in the 21st century. So what a difference a decade makes, of course. And while we were dealing with some pretty big stuff back in 2010, we always in the moment think we are now, much more aware of and living every day with multiple crises that highlight the need for change. So, you know, 2020, I mean, it's just, you know, it's such a meme, of course. So talk about the need for systems thinking today. How can it help change makers? And you can talk about this from the vantage where, you know, where you now sit. You can also maybe draw on what you were thinking, you know, when you put this together back in the first edition.
I mean, to be honest, I don't think there's been a huge amount of change as far as the nature of the change that's required. It's just that I think that people are more alert to the kind of complexities of the change that is out there, if you like, and that we're dealing with. I think people are becoming much more what we call sort of systemically aware of the interconnections between various different factors out there, and the flux of what we call the flux of events, people and ideas that are ongoing. And in my mind's eye, actually, that flux has not really changed. It's always been there. There's always things going on. And they, you know, the changes of ideas, there's change of personnel, change of perspectives, and indeed changing of different factors. You know, the whole technology of our world is changing quite rapidly. But technical change in itself is not a new thing. It's just a different quality, if you like. So one of the things that I think that's come out from the last 10 years in particular is that growing systemic sensibility, and we sort of refer to it as trying to retrieve a systemic sensibility. Children actually have a fantastic systemic sensibility. They know that things are connected together. They ask the right questions because they're always going up levels of systems. You know, when they're asking their parents, why? It's each successive why question, which can be quite irritating for parents and for teachers.
Right.
But it's actually it's demonstrating actually quite nice systemic sensibilities because it's and you can always continue to go up. And, you know, I would claim, and my colleagues would claim, that we don't ask that question enough at this time. Complexity, I mean, if I can just also add to that, Kevin, I mean, complexity science has been a really significant input as well in the last 10 years, because the development of complexity science has demonstrated two things. First of all, it's demonstrated that just about everything is connected. That you can't just isolate one set of incidences from another. Things are all interconnected. And the other thing about complexity science that I find really quite helpful is the humility that's been part of that process, that even though it's a science and it likes to be fairly well defined in getting to the truth, there's a nice humility around it, which suggests that, you know, you're never going to get the absolute truth. But a lot of these things do actually depend on the perspectives, the lens through which you are viewing those sets of interconnections. Yeah.
And context, which you write about in the book as well. So I found that interesting. So we've definitely increased our systemic sensibility. I like what you said about retrieving that systemic sensibility. I recently had the chance to speak with Tyson Yonkaporta, who writes about indigenous thinking, and in his book Sand Talk, and which definitely leads one to believe that, you know, retrieving that system sensibility also means kind of thinking about the traditional cultures and you know, those that who've come before us for thousands of years, who've actually had a lot of that sensibility already, and maybe we're ignoring it. And that's kind of where I want to, I guess, take this question is, all right, so we've got this heightened sensibility around it, but how are we doing organizationally and societally? Are we acting on that? Are we doing something about it? Are we ignoring it?
Sadly, I don't think we're certainly not doing enough. The sound bites are there, certainly in the press and in parliamentary talk. You'll hear talk of systemic failure a lot more these days. Indeed, you'll hear a lot more sort of advocacy for systems thinking. One of the problems I think that there is in people's conception of systems thinking is it tends to be quite narrowly defined. The most common sort of understanding of systems thinking is to equate it with holistic thinking. So getting the bigger picture, you know, appreciating that everything is connected, as I said before, with complexity science that has demonstrated that. And so the only issue really is to try and get a bigger picture of what's going on. And the most common form of systems thinking that addresses that is this approach called system dynamics, which is one of the five approaches in the book.
Yeah.
Really important fantastic for trying to get to see what those interrelationships are, and talking about those interrelationships in terms of causal factors and trying to observe patterns out there in terms of these kind of dynamics is really quite very, very helpful. But that's only part of the issue of systems thinking. The other issue with systems thinking is trying to get people's perspectives to engage with each other. Because however much we try to render the interconnections that are around us through things like systems maps, influence diagrams, causal loop diagrams, systems modeling, indeed, they are coming at that rendering from a particular perspective or set of perspectives. And the most important thing, it seems to me, is how you can engage other perspectives mm-hmm. in relation mm-hmm. to that problem situation. Now, you talked very well, actually, about the kind of systemic sensibilities of a lot of communities that are already out there in the world. I mean, tribal communities. There's been ancestral work. That's you know, rife with good systemic stuff out there. I mean, the problem has been how it's been communicated, how those perspectives have been recognized or indeed not recognized within the Western framework of rational thinking. So, you know, the biggest challenge, it seems to me, still with systems thinking is that although you can have the rhetoric of advocating for systems thinking, it doesn't match the practice. And the practice is really essentially about trying to engage with people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you talk about the traps in conventional thinking, that it seems like we fall into these traps. So while there might be, you know, efforts, and like you said, in the media, there are these sound bites, and we all sort of buy into this concept. Like, the pandemic has underscored so many interesting things from a systems perspective. Those who were and continue to be most affected, who are on the margins, and you know, why are they on the margins? What are we doing, and how is the system failing them and putting them in that vulnerable position? So I think that in the mainstream there is a much better understanding. But you know, you and I were talking before we began the interview, just around, you know, opening up and the anxiety and that kind of thing, and to what extent it'll be a really interesting, you know, exercise in a human experiment, really, just to see how much we you know, bring some of this new sensibility back to how we act, or do we fall into this conventional thinking, or you act in that way? You know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, it did come out quite clearly with the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic is very good in the sense of, as far as it can be good, in the sense that it did relay the importance of trying to make sense of data and the meaning behind the data. So you would have a lot of scientists given the platform, quite rightly, in trying to ascertain what was going on in the pandemic and trying to relay that to, first of all, to politicians and to policymakers, but also, of course, trying to relay it, much more importantly, to the general civil society. And that's where there are huge problems arising. You can come out with incredibly good models showing the dynamics of a particular situation, but if it's being understood in a particular way that isn't conducive to trying to solve the problem, then you've got to question it. One of the things that I think is really important with that sort of quantitative modeling that's going on with the system dynamics field is to try to understand the assumptions, because any modeling exercise has assumptions built into it. has biases. And one of the interesting things about systems thinking in that top level idea of systems thinking is that it does provide people the tools to question the boundaries which are being constructed to provide the data, the models. You know, that even though you can be absolutely blinded by the numbers game that it often comes out from the modeling exercises, particularly prevalent within the pandemic exercise, systems thinking provides you with the tools, or good systems thinking anyway, provides you with the tools to question where those judgments are being made, because essentially they're about boundary judgments. And that's essentially what systems thinking is about.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I want to come back to that because, you know, obviously the one of the approaches that you talk about is yours. It's the one you write on with Werner Ulrich toward the end of the book. I want to make sure we have some time to discuss that. We'll come back to that. But before we go too much further, I really appreciated the distinctions that you drew between messes and difficulties. And we were just talking about the pandemic and you know, obviously, you know, it's easy to throw around words, but why is it important for us to understand the difference between messes and difficulties in terms of some of these things we're dealing with?
Well, it's a question of language, but often anything else. When you talk of difficulties, you are talking again. You have sort of built-in assumptions about what the problem situation actually is, and as soon as you start talking even about problems, it's somebody's problem. It's already a defined thing. So you've got to sort of step back, as the child does, and say, "Well, why? Whose problem actually is it?" In many cases. And I think that's where the distinction between difficulties and messes comes in very helpful, I think, because as soon as you start talking about difficulties, then you are talking about something that has been bounded. Somebody has bounded it as a system. And at the end of the day, a system is a human construct. It's not something that exists out there in the world outside of our own perception. It is a perception. It's a bounded thing. And of course, the reality of the stuff out there in the world is it's unbounded. You know, it's humans that do the bounding for that. So it's humans that create the systems to make sense of the situation. I mean, another big difference that we use at the Open University is the difference between a situation of interest and a system of interest. Now, a situation of interest is the mess. It's the flux of events, people, ideas, that continual goings on of that wonderful world that we all live in. But a system of interest is actually then bounding something up. Somebody's defined it as a problem or as a difficulty. And that's okay. But you've got to then sort of start questioning, well, where did those boundary judgments actually come from? Whose boundary judgments are they?
Yeah.
And what are the consequences? Because once you start making a boundary judgment of a system, then you've got all sorts of assumptions about the subsystems, which are the activities within that system. And so, and each one of those subsystems has a boundary to them. And you can start questioning those boundary judgments as well. So it's really important that that difference between difficulty and a mess, I think, is absolutely essential in systems thinking to clarify, alert that difference and alive.
Very useful explanation. I really appreciate that. I think the listeners will as well. I think that that boundary definition and the sort of, you know, how we're constructing the so-called system is really important to understand. You know, what goes into making that actually.
Can I just add something to that, Kevin, as well? Mm-hmm. I mean, because there is quite an interesting tradition, but I mean, particularly in the United States, I think, where a lot of the systems thinking is very much closely associated with ideas of complex adaptive systems. And there's a lot of literature around that. And the complex adaptive systems has come from, and it's evolved from ideas of complexity science. So wonderful, wonderful work going on there. But when people are referring to complex adaptive systems, again, it's that problem of language, because as soon as you start thinking of a complex adaptive system as a natural, as being equated to something naturally existing, which is where its derivation is from, then you've got to be honest with yourself about the derivation of that terminology, as it were, because the complex adaptive system is very often used, is transferred from the natural world into the social world. And again, it can be a very useful translation, but it's a metaphor. It's another rendering of the situation. I think people got to continually be alert to that.
I see. Yeah. I think you've provided an explanation for something I was curious about. You have a section called Systems or Social Contracts. And I think that's kind of what you were alluding to here, and how it manifests out there in reality with people, human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned that the book was originally created as a text for students, systems thinking, and I can really see that now. You know, I love the influence diagram that you provide. I think this is a great book for people who are new and trying to make their way into and around systems thinking. But, you know, the influence diagram of different systems of traditions that shape contemporary systems practice. Just, you know, I encourage listeners to read the book and see that diagram for themselves. But if you were talking to someone who is relatively new to systems thinking, and you were to provide a short, simple explanation of this family tree, how would you do that? Like, you know, what are basically the ways that we should be thinking about or categorizing the influences?
Yeah, the influence diagram you're referring to is the one drawn by my close colleague, Ray Eisen. It's a fascinating sort of diagram showing the various different key influences on systems thinking, coming from things like complexity science, complex adaptive systems, but in particular, the emphasis is there on cybernetics and second order cybernetics, absolutely key traditions of thinking. The way in which we have structured the book. Sue Holwell, this is myself, is to kind of congest those influences into three different groups. And these are the three groups which are very much associated with what Joel Midgley and Mike Jackson have called the three waves of systems thinking. I mean, they sort of looked at the history of systems thinking in following these three different phases. So there's hard systems, soft systems, and critical systems. Now, for me, the important thing there is not so much the categorization of those particular systems traditions, but it's the emphasis given within each one of those traditions for a particular aspect of systems thinking. So in the introduction and more in the epilogue, we've articulated the a heuristic of systems thinking in practice, which is centered around these those three core elements of systems thinking. And they are, first of all, understanding interrelationships. So the stuff about getting the bigger picture, all the system dynamics, all that sort of stuff. The second aspect is engaging with multiple perspectives, what we were talking about before, that often, you know, that absolutely significant part of systems thinking, which sometimes gets waylaid, that we're talking about different perspectives and how to engage with those different perspectives. It's not just surfacing and allowing for those perspectives, being inclusive, being participatory, but it's about actually how to engage with them in a very purposeful way. And the third tradition is around actually reflecting, critically reflecting on the boundaries of the tools, of the systems that we are devising. If we accept the principle that systems are bounded constructs, they are bounded because we make judgments about them based on value judgments and based on factual judgments. And these are judgments of reality, if you like, perception and so forth. And so all the bounded ideas that we have in systems thinking must always be open to change. And there must be always that kind of continual learning about the systems that we are dealing with. And that's why we talk about systems thinking in terms of learning systems, rather than as engineered, right, sort of reified systems. Right. They're learning systems. And this is where the idea of adaptability comes in as well. So going back to your question about the categorization of these different systems approaches that Ray Eisen and others have mapped out, we've mapped out those five systems approaches, which are system dynamics, the viable system model, the strategic options development analysis, soft systems methodology, and critical systems thinking. Now, or critical systems heuristics. And we've sort of allocated in within those three different traditional patterns.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, so first of all, I think that that three-part heuristic is just such a great way to understand and sort of frame how, you know, if I want to do systems thinking and bring those practices to my organization or to my the causes I am involved in, my activist work or my change making work. I think that, you know, coming down to those key elements, and then, you know, you don't need to understand all the entire who's who of systems thinking and cybernetics. The work has built upon, you know, and the work of previous people who've come previously and evolved. And I think that these three elements that you've described are sort of like the right frame. I love threes, by the way. Three is a good number for me and my ability to sort of take things in and understand things. So I really appreciate
the key thing about this, I think, Kevin, is that it gives people the agency to muck about and play with the ideas coming from these systems traditions. Yeah. So those three aspects of systems thinking in practice just provide a very general shell framework in which they can take tools from different systems approaches and see how they may contribute towards either understanding interrelationships, engaging with the perspectives, or reflecting on the boundary judgments, you know. And there's that.
I think this is a very useful conversation for me, and I think for anyone listening, because, you know, reading about the five approaches, I come away from that and wonder, I like bits of that one, I like bits of this one, and how do I combine it? Does it make sense to sort of combine approaches depending on context or the situation or the maturity of the organization within which I'm working? Have I got the right idea?
Well, yeah, except you've missed out one really key factor there. And it's how you choose them, how you adapt them according to your own personal experiences. Every one of us have our own sort of trajectory of life experiences in which we become accustomed to using particular tools in particular ways. And for me, the most important aspect of using tools is not so much the tools themselves, it's the tools' users.
Right.
You know, a very good colleague of mine who contributed to the systems group a long time ago, John Martin, talked very recently, actually, even at the last anniversary event that we had that you missed, that you slept through. but John Martin sort of mentioned that there was something missing about the ideas being conveyed there. And these were ideas coming about complex adaptive systems. It just happened to be with Glenda O'Young. There was the missing element there, which was the tool users. How do you account for that? How do you customize? And of course, you can't. You can't possibly sort of program or advise on somebody's experiences. All you can do, and this is what we do in our Systems Thinking in Practice postgraduate program, is we provide our students with the tools. And it's not just the tools from these five systems approaches, the other tools as well. But they're allowed to play with them according to their own experiences, according to their own particular professional backgrounds. And they come from all over the place, our students in any one cohort. And then they share their experiences with each other in the course when they're in that safe space with the Open University. And it's that sharing of their experiences of using these tools where the learning comes up. And I have to say also, it's, you know, reading the dissertations and the work that comes out from the students, there's a huge amount of learning from us as well. And it's fantastic stuff, inventive stuff that they come up with.
I love it. In the viable system model chapter, Hoverstadt's chapter, he says that 80% of change projects fail. And I read that and, you know, that seems rather discouraging. I was just wondering, do you think that systems approaches improve the odds of success? Or do you think that this quote really just reflects that organizations have they give up too easily. They've set unrealistic expectations. Their KPIs, if you will, around success are maybe not the right ones. I was just curious about this this statistic and what to do with it.
Yeah, I'm not quite clear on what basis Patrick sort of has drawn that conclusion. Although I wouldn't question it. He's a very experienced consultant practitioner, Patrick. I mean, I think he's probably right that 80% of projects do fail. And the key thing there, though, is that not so much that they fail, but there's no learning from the failure. Mm-hmm. And I make this distinction between a safe fail environment and working in a safe fail environment as distinct from a fail safe environment. And it seems to me that the way in which organizations work, they work under, you know, that notion of fail safe, that they if something fails, then there's got to be a culprit to it, and there's got to be some remedial sort of action on that culprit, as it were, as a blame factor involved with it. Whereas in a safe fail environment, there's an opportunity to learn. And one of the great systems thinkers that influenced me is Charles West Churchman, an American, actually at Berkeley College. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's from your part of the woods in California. Churchman was writing in the late 60s, well, early 60s, but late 60s, early 70s. In 72, he came out with a book called The Systems Approaches, The Enemies of a Systems Approach. And the principle that he came out with there was really quite interesting. Says, you know, basically you have heroic systems thinkers who can come out with very good ideas about good purposeful systems to make things work. But at the end of the day, there's always going to be an enemy to the systems approach. And if the big problem amongst systems practitioners is we don't take into account of those people who are disaffected by our systems approaches. So what Churchman was doing, in effect, was questioning this whole kind of win-win scenario that that the organizational management buys into. It's not a win-win. There's always going to be losers. And very often, those losers can be the losers that we may want, that we may intend to be losers, but they can also bite back to the system. And they can therefore make the system fail. And it's not taking account of the disaffected, if you like, in your system's design that can actually cause the failure. And it also can cause the non-learning from that failure. I mean, the important thing around systems thinking in practice is not so much that things fail, but, you know, you've got to learn from the failure. And now good systems thinking in practice, particularly that third aspect of the heuristic, reflecting on the boundary judgments, requires that learning process. It's adaptive learning.
Right. Yeah. Right. I love that. So as you've mentioned, and you listed the five approaches that are covered in the book, and we don't have time to go into all of them, but since you're here with me, and not the other authors who you include in the book, let's talk about the chapter that you wrote with Werner Ulrich. I just happen to really like this, and you have touched on it a little bit already, but the critical systems heuristics and boundary critique is what you talk about. And I really liked this, this idea that its particular focus is on working constructively with opposing perspectives, the tensions around these opposing perspectives. And I think that just felt really timely, like right for this conversation, this we have 2020 behind us, we're a few months into 2021, but this feels like it's very topical and relevant, this kind of approach. What do you think about that, and how do you see it applying to some of the things we're dealing with at the moment?
Yeah, there are two aspects to that chapter. Werner Ulrich was a student of Wes Churchman, so very, very much influenced by the work of Wes Churchman. And that book that I just mentioned, The Systems Approach, The Enemies of a Systems Approach, Systems Approach and Its Enemies, was written by Wes Churchman at the same time that he was tutoring Werner on his PhD. And it's so the book contributed directly to the whole idea of critical systems heuristics. What Werner did really very capably and fantastically is to render the Churchman's ideas into what he called a reference system. So the reference system has these four sources of influence. And again, it's just a way of mapping the reality according to four different sources of influence. And those sources are sources of motivation, control, sources of knowledge, and sources of legitimacy. And it seems to me that you can look at any situation in the world, doesn't matter what kind of level you look at that situation, that complex mess that's out there, you can try to understand it using that lens of a reference system of CSH, in terms of a political ecology, is what I would call it, of what's going on regarding those influences. So those four influences I would describe in terms of who gets what, sources of motivation, who owns what, sources of control, who does what, who sources of knowledge, and who suffers what, the enemies of the system. Mm-hmm. Who suffers what? It's got to be a really key thing. Sources of legitimacy. So there's a template there offered by CSH, critical systems heuristics. The other thing that Werner did a little bit later, but I mean, he was trying to articulate a methodological approach behind the use of CSH. And that was what he called boundary critique. And it comes from a really strong tradition of American pragmatism, the work of William James, John Dewey, and can't remember his other name. But anyway, the American pragmatism tradition complemented with the critical social theory Germanic tradition that sort of was very much rooted in Immanuel Kant and more contemporary thinkers like Jürgen Habermas, who was very influential on Werner Ulrich. So boundary critique is this idea of, and boundary critique is underpins actually the whole STIP heuristic, that systems thinking heuristic of those three legs, understanding interrelationships, engaging with multiple perspectives and reflecting on boundary judgments. Because what he's basically saying is that there are these three different types of judgments. There's the boundary judgments, which we make about a system. So in terms of a CSH system, it would be those boundary judgments associated with those four sources of influence. But you know, you can apply that to any system, whether it's a complex adaptive system, a system dynamics model. It would have certain boundary judgments, and whether it's a soft systems methodology type thing, or whether it's a cognitive map associated with strategic options, development analysis, doesn't really matter. When you create a system, you're making boundary judgments, but those boundary judgments are influenced by two other sets of judgments. First of all, the factual judgments, what we see, what we perceive as being reality out there, but they are perceptions of reality. So science is really key to that. The discipline of science, whether it's social science or natural science, really important. But it's not the only way in which we capture reality. Of course, we use all sorts of different forms of methods to capture reality, including poems, literature, music, dance, whatever. I mean, you know, there's pictures. There's all sorts of ways of capturing that reality, but they are reality judgments. They're judgments of facts. And then there are, of course, the value judgments. And this is where the people, again, the person, that agency of the user of a systems approach comes in. Not only the systems thinking practitioner, but also those people working with the systems thinking practitioner in order to try to make those systems work. So there's those, it has that tripartite use of value judgments, factual judgments, and boundary judgments. And that's what underpins the whole
incredibly useful
practice heuristic as well.
Got it. Yeah, that is incredibly useful. That's a very helpful explanation. So we need to start to wrap up the conversation. And there's so much more we could talk about. I love the bit in the book the interaction between systems and the communities of practices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, what this kind of speaks to is a lot of, you know, the discussion around, you know, what created the difficulties and the messes, and what we're, you know, whether we're talking about, the Green New Deal here in the United States, and you know, a lot of the concepts there, and or decolonization, you know, the end of capitalism and concepts like donut economics, you know, this whole idea that the system, so-called, that created the problems or the issues, the messes, cannot be the ones that fix the issues that we're dealing with. And I wanted to know what you thought about that comment. It's something I seem to read all the time. And then, you know, the relationship between that statement and the approaches that you lay out in the book.
So the idea, and this is coming from Einstein, actually, Albert Einstein, famously said that you can't fix the problems with the same methods that cause them, sort of thing. And it speaks again to the idea that we construct systems in order to solve problems. Those problems move on. They change because, you know, they're part of a reality. They're not fixed systems. They become other problem situations for other people. So it's always a change in flux there. So you've got to have that adaptability of the system. So you can't stay with the same system. You can't stay with the same tools. And we can see that tools themselves might be regarded as systems. And again, we make that point very clear within our courses, in our teaching. So it is important to keep that sort of sense, that, again, that distinction between the system and the situation, so that when we are looking at problems, we tend to look at problems, first of all, in a very defined way. So we bound them up without any concern about how we are making those boundary judgments. But we are also bounding them up often in a kind of linear fashion, so that there's one particular influence that influences another, that influences another in a very sort of monocausal linear way. And that's the sort of way of hierarchical decision-making, which is infiltrated and implicit in most decision-making forms of governance, whether it's in an organization or on a national or regional scale. And of course, that linearity, that system of linearity, doesn't allow for the feedback, which is so important within a systems overview. And it causes failure. It goes back to Patrick Hoverstar's thing about 80% of projects being failed projects. It causes failure because there's lots of other different influences going on. And you've got to try to look at your boundary judgments with fresh eyes and reversion them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to dump all of the tools that we currently have in management. I'm very much wary of this notion that you've got to stop all of the management tools and stuff that we have and just go over to this new so-called paradigm of systems thinking. I'm very wary of that because I actually think that you can use the same tools in as inventive a way to deal with those understanding of interrelationships, engaging with perspectives, and reflecting on boundary judgments. You can do that in an inventive way. You don't need to have yet more tools and more methods. You know what I mean? So you don't
continue. I totally know what you mean. And so just to pick up on that, I'm going to do something that's really obnoxious. I know that people generally hate this, and that's when an interviewer reads the very last sentence from a book. Spoiler alert. But I think it's very appropriate to do that. And if you could be on that same page, I don't know if you have the book in front of you, but I really like how you say, in relation to the artisanal skills of a systems thinking practitioner, Mary Catherine Bateson, the late Mary Catherine Bateson, who just passed away recently, reminds us of the way of the world to which systems approaches covered in this compilation, Martin, that you've provided, continue to serve as a continually creative endeavor. I love that. And I think that really kind of speaks to what you were just saying. And so just as we finish up here, if you have the book open, would you mind reading the quote that you provide from Mary Catherine Bateson at the very end of the book?
Yeah, sure. And it is a lovely quote from Bateson.
It is.
So she says, "It's confusing, but we have a right to be confused, perhaps even a need. The trick is to enjoy it, to savor complexity and resist the easy answers, to let diversity flower into creativity."
Yeah, I love that. Well, Martin, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you. I've very much enjoyed it, Kevin. And thank you for this opportunity.
Pleasure has been, it's been all mine. So you've been listening to my conversation with Martin Reynolds, co-author of Systems Approaches to Making Change, a Practical Guide. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Systems and Cybernetics. Bye for now.